Was it all just a dream?
God bless you, Florida. Thank you.
Did the last 4 years not really happen? Look, there's Ben Affleck. He's often in my dreams. And the taxi driver guy, he was there too. And little Stevie Wonder, he seemed so happy, like a miracle had taken place. Was it a dream? Or was it real? It was election night 2000, and everything seemed to be going as planned.
In New York, Al Gore is our projected winner. The Garden State is green for Gore.
We project that Mr. Gore is the winner in Delaware. This state has voted with the winner in
Delaware. Excuse me 1 second. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Mike, you know I wouldn't do this if it weren't big. Florida goes for Al Gore.
CNN announces that we call Florida in the Al Gore column.
Then something called the Fox News Channel called the election in favor of the other guy.
I interrupt you. Fox News now projects George W. Bush the winner in Florida, and thus it appears the winner of the presidency of the United States.
All of a sudden, the other network said, hey, if Fox said it, it must be true.
All of us at the networks made a mistake and projected Florida in the Al Gore column. It was our mistake.
Now, what most people don't know is that the man who was in charge of the decision desk at Fox that night, the man who called it for Bush, was none other than Bush's first cousin, John Ellis. How does someone like Bush get away with something like this? Well, first, it helps if your brother is the governor of the state in question.
You know something? We are going to win Florida. Mark my words. You can write it down.
Second, make sure the chairman of your campaign is also the vote count woman, and that her state has hired a company that's going to knock voters off the rolls who aren't likely to vote for you. You can usually tell them by the color of their skin. Then make sure your side fights like it's life or death.
I think all this talk about legitimacy is way overblown.
And hope that the other side will just sit by and wait for the phone to ring. And even if numerous independent investigations prove that Gore got the most votes,
if there was a statewide recount under every scenario, Gore won the election.
It won't matter, just as long as all your daddy's friends on the Supreme Court vote the right way.
While I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it.
What we need now is acceptance. We have a new president-elect.
It turns out, none of this was a dream. It's what really happened. On the day the joint session of both the House of Representatives and the Senate was to certify the election results, Al Gore, in his dual role as outgoing Vice President and President of the Senate, presided over the event that would officially anoint George W. Bush as the new president. If any congressman wanted to raise an objection, the rules insisted that he or she had to have the signed support of just one senator.
Mr. President, and I take great pride in calling you that, I must object because of the overwhelming evidence of official misconduct, deliberate fraud, and an attempt to suppress voter turnout.
The chair must remind members that under Section 18 of Title III, United States Code, no debate is allowed in the joint session.
Thank you, Mr. President. To answer your question, Mr. President, the objection is in writing, signed by a number of members of the House of Representatives, but not by a member of the Senate.
Mr. President, it is in writing and signed by several House colleagues on behalf and myself of the 27,000 voters of Duval County, in which 16,000 of them are African Americans that was disenfranchised in this last election.
Is the objection signed by a member of the Senate?
Not signed by a member of the Senate. The Senate is missing.
Mr. President, it is in writing and signed by myself on behalf of many of the diverse constituents in our country, especially those in the 9th Congressional District, and all American voters who recognize that the Supreme Court, not the people of the United States, decided this election.
Is the objection signed by a senator?
Unfortunately, Mr. President, it is not signed by one single senator.
Unfortunately, I have no authority over the United States Senate, and no senator has signed.
Mr. President, it is in writing and signed by myself and several of my constituents from Florida. A senator is needed, but missing.
Is the objection in writing and signed by a member of the House and a senator.
The objection is in writing, and I don't care that it is not signed by a member of the Senate.
The chair will advise that the rules do care, and the signature of the senator.
Not a single senator came to the aid of the African Americans in Congress. One after another, they were told to sit down and shut up.
And it's a sad day in America, Mr. President, when we can't find a senator to sign
the gentleman,
objections.
New gentleman will suspend.
Won't sign objections, Mr. President.
Gentleman will. The gentleman will suspend.
Inauguration coverage, 2001, on a nasty but it could be worse kind of day in Washington.
What do we want? Justice! What do we want? Yeah!
On the day George W. Bush was inaugurated, tens of thousands of Americans poured into the streets of D.C. in one last attempt to reclaim what had been taken from them. They pelted Bush's limo with eggs and brought the inauguration parade to a halt. The plan to have Bush get out of the limo for the traditional walk to the White House was scrapped. Bush's limo hit the gas to prevent an even larger riot. No president had ever witnessed such a thing on his inauguration day. And for the next 8 months, it didn't get any better for George W. Bush. He couldn't get his judges appointed. He had trouble getting his legislation passed, and he lost Republican control of the Senate. His approval ratings in the polls began to sink. He was already beginning to look like a lame duck president. With everything going wrong, he did what any of us would do. He went on vacation. In his first 8 months in office before September 11th, George W. Bush was on vacation, according to the Washington Post, 42% of the time.
I hit every shot good. People would say I wasn't working.
It was not surprising that Mr. Bush needed some time off. Being president is a lot of work.
Got these folks that say you're loafing here in Texas, that you're taking too long of a vacation.
They don't understand the definition of work then. Getting a lot done. Secondly, you don't have to be in Washington to work. It's amazing what can happen with telephones and faxes.
Thank you so much.
And just a destiny of both.
Yeah.
What are you doing the rest of the day?
Karen Hughes is coming over. We're working on some things. And she'll be over here. We'll work on a few things. I'm working on some initiatives. You'll see. I mean, there'll be some decisions that I will have made while I'm here, and we'll be announcing them as time goes on.
The first time I met him, he had some good advice for me.
Governor Bush, it's Michael Moore.
Behave yourself, will you? Go find real work.
And work was something he knew a lot about.
Anybody want some grits?
Relaxing at Camp David, yachting off Kennebunkport.
How you doing?
Or being a cowboy on the ranch in Texas.
I love the nature. I love to get in the pickup truck with my dogs. Oh, hi.
George Bush spent the rest of August at the ranch, where life was less complicated.
Mr. Armadale loved to dig the soil looking for bugs. And I went out there the other day, and there was Barney buried in his hole, chasing an armadillo.
It was a summer to remember. And when it was over, he left Texas for his second favorite place. On September 10th, he joined his brother in Florida, where they looked at files and met important Floridians. He went to sleep that night in a bed made with fine French linens. Thank you.
suppose he's pretty confident on those numbers on Iraqi security forces.
Yeah, I got a little sort of air noise. Yeah, just don't turn it up too much so I don't want to blow my head off.
I got a mic here if they want to hear. Testing 1, 2. This is the Oval Office. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. This is the Oval Office. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Thank you.
On September 11th, 2001, nearly 3,000 people, including a colleague of mine, Bill Weems, were killed in the largest foreign attack ever on American soil. The targets were the financial and military headquarters of the United States.
If anyone has any idea if they've seen him or knows where he is, to call us. He's got two little babies.
As the attack took place, Mr. Bush was on his way to an elementary school in Florida. When informed of the first plane hitting the World Trade Center, where terrorists had struck just 8 years prior, Mr. Bush decided to go ahead with his photo opportunity.
Good morning, boys and girls.
Good morning,
Mrs.
Morning.
Read this word the fast way. Get ready.
Mad.
Yes, mad. Get ready.
Mad.
Yeah.
Okay, get ready to read the words on this page without making a mistake.
When the second plane hit the tower, his chief of staff entered the classroom and told Mr. Bush, "The nation is under attack." Not knowing what to do, with no one telling him what to do, and no Secret Service rushing in to take him to safety, Mr. Bush just sat there and continued to read My Pet Goat with the children. Nearly 7 minutes passed with nobody doing anything. As Bush sat in that Florida classroom, was he wondering if maybe he should have shown up to work more often? Should he have held at least one meeting since taking office to discuss the threat of terrorism with his head of counterterrorism? Or maybe Mr. Bush was wondering why he had cut terrorism funding from the FBI. Or perhaps he just should have read the security briefing that was given to him on August 6, 2001, which said that Osama bin Laden was planning to attack America by hijacking airplanes. But maybe he wasn't worried about the terrorist threat because the title of the report was too vague.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
A report like that might make some men jump, but as in days past, George W. just went fishing. As the minutes went by, George Bush continued to sit in the classroom. Was he thinking, "I've been hanging out with the wrong crowd"? Which one of them screwed me? Was it the guy my daddy's friends delivered a lot of weapons to? Was it that group of religious fundamentalists who visited my state when I was governor? Or was it the Saudis? Damn, it was them. I think I better blame it on this guy. In the days following September 11th, all commercial and private airline traffic was grounded.
The FAA has taken the action to close all of the airports in the United States.
Even grounding the president's father, former President Bush, on a flight forced to land in Milwaukee.
Thousands of travelers were stranded, among them Ricky Martin, due to appear at tonight's Latin Grammy Awards.
Not even Ricky Martin could fly. But really, who wanted to fly? No one. Except the bin Ladens.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do.
We had some airplanes authorized at the highest levels of our government to fly to pick up Osama bin Laden's family members and others from Saudi Arabia and transport them out of this country.
It turns out that the White House approved planes to pick up the bin Ladens and numerous other Saudis. At least six private jets and nearly two dozen commercial planes carried the Saudis and the bin Ladens out of the U.S. after September 13th. In all, 142 Saudis, including 24 members of the bin Laden family, were allowed to leave the country.
Osama's always been portrayed as the bad apple, the black sheep in the family, and then they cut off
all relationship with him around 1994. In fact, things are much more complicated than that.
You mean Osama has had contact with other family members?
That's right. In the summer of 2001, just before 9/11, one of Osama's sons got married in Afghanistan, and several family members showed up at the wedding.
Bin Laden.
That's right. So they've not cut off completely. That's really an exaggeration.
We now welcome to Larry King Live. Good to see him again. Prince Bandar, the ambassador of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the United States.
We had about 24 members of Bin Laden's family.
Here?
In America. Students. And His Majesty felt it's not fair for those innocent people to be subjected to any harm. On the other hand, we understood had a high emotion. So with coordination with the FBI, we got them all out.
This is retired FBI agent Jack Clunan. Before 9/11, he was a senior agent on the joint FBI-CIA Al-Qaeda task force.
I, as an investigator, would not want these people to have left. I think in the case of the Bin Laden family, I think it would have been prudent, hand the subpoenas out, have them come in, get on the record. You know, get on the record.
That's the proper procedure.
Yeah. How many people were pulled off of airlines after that coming into the country who were what? They were from the Middle East, or they fit a very general picture.
We held hundreds of
people. We held hundreds.
Weeks and months at a time.
Did the authorities do anything when the Bin Ladens tried to leave the country?
No, they were identified at the airport. They looked at their passports, and they were identified.
Well, that's what would happen to you or I if we were leaving
exactly,
the country.
Exactly, exactly.
So a little interview, check the passport, what else?
Nothing.
I don't know about you, but usually when the police can't find a murderer, don't they usually want to talk to the family members to find out where they think he might be?
You have no idea where your husband might be.
Well, if you should hear anything, let us know, will you?
You willing to come downtown and give us a statement?
This is going to take long.
You got the time.
Mine's worth money. Yours isn't.
Send in a bill.
I asked you a question.
You're here to answer them, not ask them.
Now, you listen to me, cop. I pay your salary.
All right, sit down. I'm going to earn it.
Yeah, that's how cops do it. What was going on here?
I think we need to know a lot more about that. That needs to be the subject of a significant investigation. What happened? How did it happen? Why did it happen? And who authorized it?
Trying to imagine what those poor bastards were feeling when they were jumping out of that building to their death. Those young guys and cops and firemen that ran into that building never asked a question, and they're dead. And families' lives are ruined. And they'll never have peace. And if I had to inconvenience a member of the Bin Laden family with a subpoena or a grand jury, do you think I'd lose any sleep over it? Not for a minute, Mike.
No one would question it.
No, it's right.
Not even the biggest civil libertarian.
No, it's
no
just,
one would question it.
It's just, you know, you got a lawyer, fine. Counselor, fine. Mr. Bin Laden, this is why I'm asking you. It's not because I think that you're anything. I just want to ask you the questions that I would anybody.
Right.
And that's all.
None of this made any sense. Can you imagine in the days after the Oklahoma City terrorist bombing, President Clinton helping to arrange a trip out of the country for the McVeigh family? What do you think would have happened to Clinton if that had been revealed?
Bandar, do you know the Bin Laden family?
I do very well.
What are they like?
They're really lovely human beings. He is the only one I don't know him well, but I met him only once.
What was the circumstance under which you met him?
This is ironic. In mid-80s, if you remember, we in the United States were supporting the Mujahideen to liberate Afghanistan from the Soviets. He came to thank me for my efforts to bring the Americans, our friends, to help us against the atheist, he said, the communist. Isn't it ironic?
In other words, he came to thank you for helping bring America to help him. And now he may be responsible for bombing him. America.
Absolutely.
What did you make of him when you met him?
I was not impressed, to be honest with you.
Not impressed?
No. I thought he was a simple and very quiet guy.
A simple and quiet guy whose family just happened to have a business relationship with the family of George W. Bush. Is that what he was thinking about? Because if the public knew this, it wouldn't look very good. Was he thinking, you know, I need a big black marker? In early 2004, in a speech during the New Hampshire primary, I called George W. Bush a deserter from his time in the Texas Air National Guard. In response, the White House released his military records in the hopes of disproving the charge. What Bush didn't know is that I already had a copy of his military records, uncensored, obtained in the year 2000. And there is one glaring difference between the records released in 2000 and those he released in 2004. A name had been blacked out. In 1972, two airmen were suspended for failing to take their medical examination. One was George W. Bush. And the other was James R. Bath. In 2000, the documents show both names. But in 2004, Bush and the White House had Bath's name blacked out. Why didn't Bush want the press and the public to see Bath's name on his military records? Perhaps he was worried that the American people would find out that at one time James R. Bath was the Texas money manager for the Bin Ladens. Bush and Bath had become good friends when they both served in the Texas Air National Guard. After they were discharged, when Bush's dad was head of the CIA, Bath opened up his own aviation business after selling a plane to a man by the name of Salim Bin Laden, heir to the second largest fortune in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Bin Laden Group.
W at that time was just starting off in the world as a businessman. Because he's a guy who's always tried to emulate his father, he decided to go into the oil business. He founded an oil company, a drilling company out in West Texas called Arbusto, which was very, very good at drilling dry holes that nothing came out of. But the question has always been, where did this money come from? Now, his dad was rich. His dad could have done this for him, but his dad didn't do this for him. There's no indication that daddy wrote a check to start him off in this company.
So where did George W. Bush get his money?
I'm George Bush.
One person who did invest in him was James R. Bath. Bush's good friend, James Bath, was hired by the Bin Laden family to manage their money in Texas and invest in businesses. And James Bath himself, in turn, invested in George W. Bush. Bush ran Arbusto into the ground, as he did every other company he was involved in, until finally one of his companies was bought by Harkin Energy, and they gave him a seat on their board.
A lot of us have suspected through the years that there has been Saudi oil money involved in all of these companies. Harkin, Spectrum 7, Arbusto Drilling, all of the Bush companies. Whenever they got into trouble, there were these angel investors who flowed money into the companies.
So the question is, why would Saudis, who had all the oil in the world, go around the globe to invest in this lousy oil company? And the thing is, it had one big asset. Harkin had one thing going for it, which is that George W. Bush was on its board of directors at a time when his father was president of the United States.
When you're the president's son and you've got unlimited access combined with some credentials from a prior campaign, in Washington, D.C., people tend to respect that. I mean, access is power. And I can find my dad and talk to him any time of the day.
Yes, it helps to be the president's son, especially when you're being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission.
In 1990, when Mr. Bush was a director of Harkin Energy, he received this memo from company lawyers warning directors not to sell stock if they had unfavorable information about the company. 1 week later, he sold $848,000 worth of Harkin stock. 2 months later, Harkin announced losses of more than $23 million.
The James Baker law partner who helped Bush beat the rap from the SEC was a man by the name of Robert Jordan, who, when George W. became president, was appointed ambassador to Saudi Arabia. After the Harkin debacle, the friends of Bush's dad got him a seat on another board of a company owned by the Carlyle Group.
We wanted to look at which companies actually gained from September 11th. Turned up this company, Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group is a multinational conglomerate that invests in heavily government-regulated industries like telecommunications, healthcare, and particularly defense. Both George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush worked for the Carlyle Group, the same company that counted the Bin Laden family among its investors. Carlyle Group was holding its annual investor conference on the morning of September 11th in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, D.C. At that meeting were all of the Carlyle regulars. James Baker, likely John Major, definitely George H.W. Bush, though he left the morning of September 11th. Shafiq Bin Laden, who is Osama Bin Laden's half-brother, and was in town to look after his family's investments in the Carlyle Group. All of them together in one room watching as the planes hit the towers, and that in fact the Bin Laden family was invested in one of their defense funds, which ironically meant that as the United States started increasing its defense spending, the Bin Laden family stood to gain from those investments through the Carlyle Group.
Our Commander-in-Chief, President George W. Bush.
With all the weapons companies it owned, the Carlyle Group was, in essence, the 11th largest defense contractor in the United States.
Thanks a lot.
It owned United Defense, makers of the Bradley Armored Fighting Vehicle. September 11th guaranteed that United Defense was going to have a very good year. Just 6 weeks after 9/11, Carlyle filed to take United Defense public, and in December, made a one-day profit of $237 million. But sadly, with so much attention focused on the Bin Laden family being important Carlyle investors, the Bin Ladens eventually had to withdraw. Bush's dad, though, stayed on as senior advisor to Carlyle's Asia board for another 2 years.
As unseemly as it seems to know that George H.W. Bush was meeting with the Bin Laden family while Osama was a wanted terrorist well before September 11th, it's very discomforting for Americans to know that. George H.W. Bush is a man who has obviously incredible reach into the White House. He receives daily CIA briefings, which is the right of any ex-president, but very few ex-presidents actually exercise that right. He does, and I think in a very real way, they are benefiting from the confusion that arises when George H.W. Bush visits Saudi Arabia on behalf of Carlyle and meets with the royal family and meets with the Bin Laden family. Is he representing the United States of America, or is he representing an investment firm in the United States of America, or is he representing both? This company is about money. It's not about conspiracies to run the world or engineer political maneuvering and things like that. It's about making money, and it's about making a lot of money, and they've done very well.
I could get you on the record on this question. In the White House view, there's no ethical conflict in former President Bush and former Secretary of State Jim Baker using their contacts with world leaders to represent one of the most well-known military arms dealers, the Carlyle Group.
The President has full faith that his family will conform with all proper ethics laws, and will act properly in their conduct.
Okay, so let's say one group of people, like the American people, pay you $400,000 a year to be president of the United States. But then another group of people invest in you, your friends, and their related businesses $1.4 billion over a number of years. Who are you gonna like? Who's your daddy? Because that's how much the Saudi royals and their associates have given the Bush family.
Morning, everybody. Oh, we know
their friends.
How are you, sir?
And their related businesses in the past three decades.
Seems like a very nice reunion with friends.
Is it rude to suggest that when the Bush family wakes up in the morning, they might be thinking about what's best for the Saudis instead of what's best for you or me? Because $1.4 billion just doesn't buy a lot of flights out of the country. It buys a lot of love.
Shiny, happy people holding. Shiny, happy people holding.
Sooner or later, this special relationship with a regime that Amnesty International condemns as a widespread human rights violator would come back to haunt the Bushes. Now, after 9/11, it was an embarrassment, and they preferred that no one ask any questions.
The investigation should have begun on September 12th. There's no reason why it shouldn't have. 3,000 people were dead. It was a murder, and it should have gotten started immediately.
First, Bush tried to stop Congress from setting up its own 9/11 investigation.
It's important for us to not reveal how we collect information. That's what the enemy wants, and we're fighting an enemy.
When he couldn't stop Congress, he then tried to stop an independent 9/11 commission from being formed.
The president's position was a break from history. Independent investigations were launched within days of Pearl Harbor and President Kennedy's assassination.
But when Congress did complete its own investigation, the Bush White House censored 28 pages of the report.
The president is being pressed by all sides to declassify the report. U.S. officials tell NBC News most of the secret sources involve Saudi Arabia.
We have given extraordinary cooperation with Chairman Keane and Hamilton.
We haven't gotten the materials we needed, and we certainly haven't gotten them in a timely fashion. The deadlines we set have passed.
Will you testify before the commission?
This commission? You know, I don't testify. I mean, I'd be glad to visit with them.
What it will do is hold this in my heart and has been in my heart since September 11th. I lost my husband 15 years. I am now by myself. I need to know what happened to him. I know what I got back from the autopsy. That man was my life, and I have no plan. I was taking a class, and they asked me, what was I going to do in the next 5 years? And if I'm not doing something with this, I don't know what reason I have to live. So it's very important. Very important. Okay. Thank
you. Ignored by the Bush administration, more than 500 relatives of 9/11 victims filed suit against Saudi royals and others. The lawyers the Saudi defense minister hired to fight the 9/11 families? The law firm of Bush family confidant, James A. Baker.
So we're right here in the center of three important American landmarks, the Watergate Hotel and office building, the Kennedy Center over there, and the embassy of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
how much money do the Saudis have invested in America, roughly?
I've heard figures as high as $860
billion. $860
billion? Billion.
That's a lot of money.
A lot, yeah. Uh-huh.
And what percentage of our economy does that represent? I mean, it seems like a lot.
Well, in terms of investments on Wall Street, American equities, it's roughly 6 or 7% of America. They own a fairly good slice of America.
Wow.
And most of that money goes into the great blue chip companies. Citigroup, Citibank is the largest stockholder as a Saudi. AOL, Time Warner has big Saudi investors.
So I read where, like, the Saudis have $1 trillion in our banks of their money. What would happen if, like, one day we just pulled that $1 trillion out?
$1 trillion? That would be an enormous blow to the economy.
Right, right.
Mr. Morcus, can you come out, please, sir?
Yeah, sure.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good. How
are
you doing?
Steve Kim with Secret Service. How are you doing,
sir? Yes.
We're just ascertaining information regarding... Are you doing a documentary regarding the Saudi Arabia embassy or chancery?
I am doing a documentary. Okay. And part of it is about Saudi Arabia.
Even though we were nowhere near the White House, for some reason the Secret Service had shown up to ask us what we were doing standing across the street from the Saudi embassy.
Here to cause any trouble or anything. And, you know, is that...
No, that's fine. We just wanted to make sure, we just wanted to get some information as far as actually what was actually occurring.
What's going on? Yeah.
I didn't realize the Secret Service guards foreign embassies.
Not usually, no, sir.
No. Did they give you any trouble, Saudis?
No comment on that. Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll take that as a yes. All right, good. Thank you very much. Thanks for the work you did.
It turns out that Saudi Prince Bandar is perhaps the best protected ambassador in the U.S. The U.S. State Department provides him with a 6-man security detail. Considering how he and his family and the Saudi elite own 7% of America, it's probably not a bad idea. Prince Bandar was so close to the Bushes, they considered him a member of the family, and they even had a nickname for him, Bandar Bush. Two nights after September 11th, George Bush invited Bandar Bush over to the White House for a private dinner and a talk. Even though bin Laden was a Saudi, and Saudi money had funded al-Qaeda, and 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, here was the Saudi ambassador casually dining with the president on September 13th. What were they talking about? Were they commiserating or comparing notes? Why would Bandar's government block American investigators from talking to the relatives of the 15 hijackers? Why would Saudi Arabia become reluctant to freeze the hijackers' assets? The two of them walked out on the Truman balcony so that Bandar could smoke a cigar and have a drink. In the distance, across the Potomac, was the Pentagon, partially in ruins. I wonder if Mr. Bush told Prince Bandar not to worry, because he already had a plan in motion.
You come in September 12th, ready to plot what response we take to al-Qaeda. Right. Let me talk to about the response that you got from top administration officials. On that day, what did the president say to you?
The president, in a very intimidating way, left us, me and my staff, with the clear indication that he wanted us to come back with the word that there was an Iraqi hand behind 9/11, because they had been planning to do something about Iraq from before the time they came into office.
Did he ask about any other nations other than Iraq?
No, not at all. It was Iraq, Saddam, find out, get back to me.
And were his questions more about Iraq than about al-Qaeda?
Absolutely. He didn't ask me about al-Qaeda.
And the reaction you got that day from the defense secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, from his assistant, Paul Wolfowitz?
Well, Donald Rumsfeld said, when we talked about bombing the al-Qaeda infrastructure in Afghanistan, he said there were no good targets in Afghanistan. Let's bomb Iraq. And we said, but Iraq had nothing to do with this. And that didn't seem to make much difference. And the reason they had to do Afghanistan first was it was obvious that al-Qaeda had attacked us, and it was obvious that al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan. The American people wouldn't have stood by if we had done nothing on Afghanistan.
The United States began bombing Afghanistan just 4 weeks after 9/11. Mr. Bush said he was doing so because the Taliban government of Afghanistan had been harboring bin Laden.
We will smoke him out of their holes.
We're going to smoke him out.
Smoke him out.
We'll smoke him out of his cave.
Let's rush him and smoke him out.
For all his tough talk, Bush really didn't do much.
But what they did was slow and small. They put only 11,000 troops into Afghanistan. There are more police here in Manhattan, than there are U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Basically, the president botched the response to 9/11. He should have gone right after bin Laden. The U.S. Special Forces didn't get into the area where bin Laden was for 2 months.
2 months? A mass murderer who attacked the United States was given a 2-month head start? Who in their right mind would do that?
Dang. Anybody say nice shot?
Nice shot.
Hell of a shot.
Or was the war in Afghanistan really about something else? Perhaps the answer was in Houston, Texas. In 1997, while George W. Bush was governor of Texas, a delegation of Taliban leaders from Afghanistan flew to Houston to meet with UNICAL executives to discuss the building of a pipeline through Afghanistan, bringing natural gas from the Caspian Sea. And who got a Caspian Sea drilling contract the same day UNICAL signed the pipeline deal? A company headed by a man named Dick Cheney, Halliburton.
From the point of view of the U.S. government, this was kind of a magic pipeline because it could serve so many purposes.
And who else stood to benefit from the pipeline? Bush's number one campaign contributor, Kenneth Lay, and the good people of Enron. Only the British press covered this trip. Then in 2001, just 5.5 months before 9/11, the Bush administration welcomed a special Taliban envoy to tour the United States to help improve the image of the Taliban government.
You have imprisoned the women. It's a horror, let me tell you.
And I'm really sorry to your husband. He might have a very difficult time with you.
Here is the Taliban official visiting our State Department to meet with U.S. officials. Why on earth would the Bush administration allow a Taliban leader to visit the United States, knowing that the Taliban were harboring the man who bombed the USS Cole and our African embassies? Well, I guess 9/11 put a stop to that. When the invasion of Afghanistan was complete, we installed its new president, Hamid Karzai. Who was Hamid Karzai? He was a former advisor to UNICAL. Bush also appointed as our envoy to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, who was also a former UNICAL advisor. I guess you can probably see where this is leading. Faster than you can say black gold, Texas tea, Afghanistan signed an agreement with their neighboring countries to build a pipeline through Afghanistan carrying natural gas from the Caspian Sea. Oh, and the Taliban? Well, they mostly got away. As did Osama bin Laden and most of Al-Qaeda.
Terror is bigger than one person. And he's a person who's now been marginalized. So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him, Kelly, to be honest with you.
Didn't spend much time on him? What kind of president was he?
I'm a war president. I make decisions here in the Oval Office in foreign policy matters with war on my mind.
With the war in Afghanistan over and bin Laden forgotten, the war president had a new target. The American people.
We've got an unusual terror warning from the feds to tell you about. Fox News has obtained an FBI bulletin that warns terrorists could use pen guns, just like in James Bond, filled with poison as weapons.
Good evening, everyone. America is on high alert tonight, just 4 days before Christmas.
A possible terror threat as bad as or worse than 9/11.
But where? How? There's nothing specific to report.
Be on the lookout for model airplanes packed with explosives.
And the FBI is warning ferries may be considered particularly at risk for hijacking.
Could these cattle be a target for terrorists?
Fear works.
Fear does work, yes. You can make people do anything if they're afraid.
And how do you make them afraid?
Well, you make them afraid by creating an aura of endless threat. They played us like an organ. They raised the orange, and then up to red, and then they dropped it back to orange. I mean, they gave these mixed messages, which were crazy-making.
The world has changed after September the 11th. It's changed because we're no longer safe. Fly and enjoy America's great destination spots.
We've entered what may very well prove to be the most dangerous security environment the world's known.
Take your families and enjoy life.
Terrorists are doing everything they can to gain even deadlier means of striking us.
Get down to Disney World in Florida.
It's like training a dog. You tell them sit down and you tell them to roll over at the same time. Dog doesn't know what to do. Well, American people were being treated like that. It was really very, very skillfully and ugly in what they did.
We must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
All right, we need another. They will continue, in my view, as long as this administration is in charge, of every once in a while stimulating everybody to be afraid, just in case you forgot. It's not going to go down to green or blue. It's never going to get there. There clearly is no way that anyone can live constantly on edge like that.
The harsh reality facing American families today is that they're not as safe as they used to be. Drug dealers and users looking for their next fix, gangs who roam the streets in search of their next victim, and the growing threat of terrorists means the need for protection is ever greater. And now, that protection is here. Zytec Engineering LLC has developed and tested a safe room, finally affordable to the average American citizen. the kind of protection formerly obtainable only by the wealthy or powerful.
Heck, you can be sitting in here drinking your finest Bordeaux and enjoying life while chaos is erupting outside.
Every family in America should prepare itself for a terrorist attack.
Now to escaping from a skyscraper. John Rivers is the CEO of the Executive Chute Corporation. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Matt.
Tell me about the product you're bringing to the market.
It's a emergency escape chute. It's an option of last resort.
How high do you have to be in the building for that chute to actually take effect?
You only have to be on the 10th floor or above.
They can put this on themselves?
Right. They can put this on themselves in as easy as about 30 seconds. It's real easy to put on.
Here. Sorry.
It's okay. Real easy to put on, but when you first get this chute, you're going to want to put it on and try it on a few times yourself.
Jamie's having a little trouble putting that thing on, I want to mention. I mean, is this something that you honestly think in a moment of panic that someone can operate properly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. This is actually Jamie's probably never put this thing on before in her life, so it's okay. Don't worry about it. It's something that when you get it, you're going to want to put it on several times.
Well, despite the raising of the terror alert level, residents here in Saginaw are continuing with their Christmas errands. Frances Troik and her family do some last-minute holiday shopping, knowing that Al-Qaeda is planning to attack America. She says being in Saginaw doesn't make her feel any safer than if she was in New York City.
Midland is close by, and I said, Detroit's that far away. I said, they could be something, and Flint, this could be something, concerns for people around here.
Well, you never know where they're going to hit. You never know where they're going to hit.
But one potential target specifically mentioned by the terrorist has security officials baffled. It's tiny Tappahannock, Virginia, population 2016. Such an attack could generate widespread fear that even here in rural small-town America, no one is entirely safe.
On the 6 o'clock news, there was something but a terrorist alert in Tappahannock.
What'd the FBI tell you?
Well, they contacted me by phone, basically let me know about this word Tappahannock, and that's how it started.
And their so-called chatter that they pick up, they wasn't sure Tappahannock, it is a Rappahannock County, this is the Rappahannock River.
There is a Rappahannock, a place called Rappahannock, and they got it mixed up.
This Tappahannock, not Rappahannock.
Is there any terrorist target around here?
Not that we can really think of.
It can happen anywhere.
We have a Walmart here.
We're having a big spaghetti supper in here.
Walmart, probably.
Do you feel extra suspicious of outsiders?
Oh, well, everybody does it. It's just something that happens.
When I look at certain people, I wonder, oh my goodness, do you think they could be a terrorist?
You never know what's going to happen.
That's right, you never know
what's going to happen. It's going to happen right now, you know.
Never trust nobody you don't know. And even if you do know them, you really can't trust them then.
From Tappahannock to Rappahannock to every town and village in America, the people were afraid. And they turned to their leader to protect them. But protect them from what?
Let the eagle soar like she's never soared before, from rocky coast to golden shore.
Meet John Ashcroft. In 2000, he was running for re-election as senator from Missouri against a man who died the month before the election. The voters preferred the dead guy, so George W. Bush made him his attorney general. He was sworn in on a stack of Bibles, because when you can't beat a dead guy, you need all the help you can get. During the summer before 9/11, Ashcroft told acting FBI Director Thomas Picard that he didn't want to hear anything more about terrorist threats.
Mr. Watson had come to you and said that the CIA was very concerned that there would be an attack. You said that you told the Attorney General this fact repeatedly in these meetings. Is that correct?
I told him at least on two occasions.
And you told the staff, according to this statement, that Mr. Ashcroft told you that he did not want to hear about this anymore. Is that correct?
That is correct.
His own FBI knew that summer that there were al-Qaeda members in the U.S. and that bin Laden was sending his agents to flight schools around the country. But Ashcroft's Justice Department turned a blind eye and a deaf ear. But after 9/11, John Ashcroft had some brilliant ideas for how to protect America.
The USA Patriot Act, adopted by Congress and signed by Bush 6 weeks after the attacks, has changed the way the government does business. The USA Patriot Act allows for searches of medical and financial records, computer and telephone conversations, and even for the books you take out of the library. But most of the people we spoke to say they're willing to give up some liberties to fight terrorism.
Maybe that's a good thing.
It's definitely sad, but it has to be done.
Yes, something needed to be done. These are the good people who make up Peace Fresno, a community group in Fresno, California. Unlike the rest of us, they've received an early lesson in what the Patriot Act is all about. Each week, they meet to discuss matters of peace. They sit around, they share stories, they eat cookies. Some have more than one. This is Aaron Stokes, a member of Peace Fresno. The other members liked him.
He had come to the meetings. He went with us. We go out on Friday nights and stand on a very busy corner in Fresno. And he had gone with us. He had handed out flyers. He went with us in June to a WTO protest.
Then one day, Aaron didn't show up to the meeting.
My friend Dan and I were reading the Sunday newspaper. And when I picked up the paper, in the local section, Aaron's picture caught my eye. The article said that a sheriff's deputy had been killed, and I saw it had a name that wasn't the right name, and it said that he was a member of the sheriff's anti-terrorism unit.
That's right. The photo of the man in the newspaper was not the Aaron Stokes they had come to know. He was actually Deputy Aaron Kilner, and he had infiltrated their group.
Sheriff Pierce made it very clear that, yes, in fact, Aaron Kilner was assigned to infiltrate Peace Fresno, that he was able to infiltrate organizations that are open to the public.
You could understand why the police needed to spy on a group like Peace Fresno. Just look at them. A gathering of terrorists, if I ever saw one. This is Barry Rheingold, a retired phone worker from Oakland, California. Barry likes to work out in the gym. Somewhere between his cardio and his strength training, Barry got political.
We're up in the gym, and it was after we were working out, and a number of us were talking about 9/11 and Afghanistan and bin Laden, and someone said, "Bin Laden's a real asshole for murdering those people." And I said, "Yeah, that's true, but he'll never be as big an asshole as Bush, who bombs all over the world for oil profits."
Barry didn't have to worry about the police spying on him. His fellow weightlifters were more than willing to turn him in.
I was taking a nap, and I guess it was 1:30, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they came to my place. And
I said, "Well, who's there?" And I said, "The FBI." I said, "The FBI? I mean, why are they here?"
Yes, the FBI had come to see Barry. And they weren't there to jazzercise.
The FBI said, "Have you been talking to people about 9/11 and about bin Laden and oil profits in Afghanistan?" I said, "A lot of people are talking about these things. I feel my rights have been, you know, trampled on. I mean, if you have something to say to me in the gym, well then, fine. Don't tell the FBI and they come to my apartment while I'm taking a nap."
There's nothing to be ashamed of here. There's full transparency. There's nothing about the Patriot Act that I'm ashamed of in any way, shape, or form. I have a 1-800 number. Call me. I'm the guy you call if there's a violation or an abuse. If you've got a poster child on this, I want to see it. That's what I do. I'm hired by the people of the United States to provide oversight. I provide oversight.
Trent Lotz said the day the bill was introduced, "Maybe now we can do things we've wanted to do for the last 10 years.
No, I've always, you know, a dictatorship would be a heck of a lot easier. There's no question about it.
I mean, they had all this on the shelf somewhere, ideas of things they would like to do. And they got 9/11 and they said, It's our chance. Go for it.
There was an immediate assumption on the part of the administration that there had to be a surrender of certain of our rights.
There's several definitions in the bill that are quite troubling. First of all, the definition of terrorist, and it's so expansive that it could include people who...
Like me.
No one read it. That's the whole point. They wait till the middle of the night, they drop it in the middle of the night, it's printed in the middle of the night, and the next morning when we come in, it passes.
How could Congress pass this Patriot Act without even reading it?
Sit down, my son. We don't read most of the bills. Do you really know what that would entail if we were to read every bill that we passed? Well, the good thing, it would slow down the legislative process.
I couldn't believe that virtually no member of Congress had read the Patriot Act before voting on it. So I decided the only patriotic thing to do was for me to read it to them.
Members of Congress, this is Michael Moore. I would like to read to you the USA Patriot Act. Section 1, Section 210 of this code reads as follows.
Section 1.